My message is not real long today, so I thought I might take a moment to read or cover something that I noticed that I thought might be of interest. If you can put that slide up there, that'd be helpful. I'm sure you've all been interested in all the images and the pictures we've gotten back from these various globally circling telescopes. I've forgotten the newest one. One was Hubble. What's the other one? Brent, do you know? James Webb, the newest one. And they have discovered all kinds of interesting things. And if you're like me, you probably thought about, well, God created this incredible universe, and it's so extensive that we have really no good idea. Of course, the scientists all believe in this thing called the Big Bang. So according to the Big Bang, it started as some very condensed thing and then blew up. And based on that presumption, they believed that they would never find anything particularly organized or extraordinary as they look out into deep space. So I ran across this article, and I thought you might find it interesting. I did. It's titled, "Huge Structure in Space Challenges Our Understanding of the Universe, Scientists Say." A story by Andrew Griffin. It was in several newspapers and online magazines and so on, from January 12th. It says, scientists have found a vast megastructure in space that appears to challenge our understanding of the universe. The ultra-large structure of galaxies named the Big Ring and stretching 1.3 billion light-years across joins the previously discovered and similar Giant Arc. Now, I've never heard of the Giant Arc. Apparently, it's been known for some time. Both appear in similar parts of the sky, and both are thought to be too large to exist. The size of the pair appears to be in contradiction of a fundamental assumption about the universe known as the cosmological principle. That suggests that at a certain level, the universe should be similar. As I mentioned, they think that everything exploded and all these elements and things were hurled into space, so there really shouldn't be any organization to it. It suggests that the universe should be similar with no particular notable large irregularities. But these huge structures violate that principle since they are so large. And if you look over there, you'll see the only thing that they showed as a validation of that was this slide that I have over here, and you'll see the Big Ring and the Giant Arc. They're too big and too remarkable to even be possible, astronomers say. Neither of them can be easily explained in our understanding of the current universe. The cosmological principle assumes that the part of the universe we can see is viewed is a fair sample of what we expect the rest of the universe to be like. We expect matter to be evenly distributed everywhere in space when we view the universe on a large scale, so there should be no noticeable irregularities above a certain size, said Alexia Lopez, the University of Central Lancashire student who discovered both of these structures. Cosmologists calculate the current theoretical size limit of the structures to be 1.2 billion light years. Yet both of these structures are much larger. The Giant Arc is almost three times bigger, and the Big Ring's circumference is comparable to the Giant Arc's length. From current cosmological theories, we didn't think structures on this scale were possible. We could expect maybe one exceedingly large structure in all of our observable universe, yet the Big Ring and the Giant Arc are two huge structures and are even cosmological neighbors, which is extraordinarily fascinating. Astronomers believe that new explanations might be needed to align the structures with our understanding of the rest of the universe. So I thought that was interesting, and obviously they're going to discover more and more things, and eventually they'll find out that there was no Big Bang in the way they viewed it, and God laid out the universe, and perhaps there's these huge structures out there may have some organization that they can't even recognize now. So I'm going to get on to my main message. In April of 1957, on a news television show, the BBC, which I think everybody knows the BBC is the British Broadcasting Corporation, they delivered a story about, don't laugh please, about a group of pasta farmers in Switzerland. It purported to feature a Swiss family who had harvested a record amount of spaghetti from their family-owned spaghetti tree. Included in the story were discussions with the farmers about how they were able to grow spaghetti noodles on their trees to the length that they desired, as well as methods for caring for their extraordinary trees. Now, at the time, the BBC was the largest and, in fact, the only broadcaster in the nation of Great Britain. So millions of people in the British Isles watched this very informative program. Now, apparently, many British citizens at the time had a very limited knowledge of pasta. As a result, hundreds of people picked up their phones to call the network, wanting to know where they might be able to acquire such a tree and then could grow their own spaghetti. The BBC did not issue a statement before the telecast that the report was actually a harmless prank. I mentioned it was April 1st for April Fool's Day. So quite a few people displayed their ignorance on that particular occasion. Now, all of us at some time or another have acted foolishly. Many times after I've said or done something foolish, I recognized right away how dumb it was what I said. And I think I can speculate that every adult in this room has experienced a time when they realized that their words were kind of foolish. Now, in most cases, our foolishness was just sort of stupid and quite often embarrassing, but most times it was not a sin. And we wouldn't want to act in a way that caused God to call us a fool. So has God ever had a reason to call you or I a fool by what we said or what we did? Well, there's a situation described in the Bible that could result in both happening. And further, if we fall into this situation, we could also incur God's wrath. So today we're going to delve into a subject that could cause us to sin. It's one that requires us to think before we act. Now I'm talking about the proclivity that all of us have to sometime speak before we think, to misuse our speech. But I'll limit our speech today to a specific type of speech. We'll focus today on statements that we can make that can be categorized as a vow, an oath, or swearing. And regarding these three, if we're not careful in our choice of words, God might categorize us as a fool, or even worse, as a sinner. Now, before I go much further, I want to acknowledge some of the sources that I used when I was preparing this message. As I do with most messages, I like to look at the UCG Bible commentaries. And also, there was a couple sermons that I listened to, one of which was by a pastor, Don McCoy, who gave a sermon on this subject in 2019. So let's start by recalling some advice by Christ's half-brother, James, in his letter, in the letter of James. So if you'll turn over to James chapter 3. James chapter 3, we're going to read some words that James wrote. He says, "For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouth that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and they're driven by fierce winds, they're turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it is set on fire by hell. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Verse 10, out of the same mouth proceeds blessings and cursings. My brethren, these ought not to be. So can any of us claim here that we're a perfect man, that we've tamed our own tongue? Now, I can recall a statement that I heard my mom say many times to me when I was young, perhaps hundreds of times. She'd say, Robert, or Bob, I forget what she called me, you get in more trouble with your mouth than any other thing. And that was generally followed by a command to be exiled to my room for a period of time. Now, there are many ways we can sin with our speech, and one way is to lie. That's to break the ninth commandment. But that's not what I'll focus on here today. Instead, we're going to look at specific ways that we can sin with our words. So the first one I want to look at is a vow. So first of all, what is a vow, and how is it used in the Scripture? Well, the broad majority of times that we see the word translated, mostly in the Old Testament, as a vow, is a Hebrew word, Hebrew noun, neder. And it means a promise to God or a thing that's promised. The verb form of this word is very similar. It's nadar. It's the act of making a vow. Now, in the New Testament, there's only two instances of the word translated as vow. They use the Greek word euche, and it's spelled E-U-C-H-E, and it means a prayer to God, a vow, a wish, or something expressed as a petition to God, very similar to what's used in the Old Testament. Simply put, it's a statement or a request that a person formally makes directed to God. It obligates the person, the speaker, to perform some action, and it includes a request from God for some type of intervention or action or a blessing from God. A person who makes a vow might speak it out loud, or they may issue it silently. It could be spoken in the company of others or by the person themselves, but whichever method, it's a direct communication between the person and God. So when a person has made a vow to God, again, either out loud or silently, it immediately becomes a legal obligation, not one that's recognized by a human court, but one that God himself records. The one who makes an oath has therefore obligated himself. They have a commitment to fulfill what they've promised. Now, in this society, we may have heard of occasions when a person who's desperate and they cry out to God for help, perhaps they're even facing death. And a vow in this kind of situation might take the form of something like this. God, if you save me from drowning in the middle of this ocean, I'll never blank again. Or I'll go to church every week for the rest of my life. So would those be valid vows? Well, yes, they may have been issued rather foolishly, but they're all both vows. And it depends on whether the person follows through on his promise that he's made to God. A vow is a type of promise that requires a person to completely follow through on what they've said. So turn in your Bibles to the book of Psalms, and we'll look at chapter 15. Excuse me. Psalm chapter 15. And we have a psalm by David, and he's going to ask a very, very important question. Verse 1, David says, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? So David is going to discuss a subject that affects each and every one of us here, the question of who will be in God's holy hill. In other words, who will be in God's kingdom? So what he writes afterwards is pretty important to us. So what did God inspire David to say? Verse 2, he who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. So a person who obeys God, he's following God's righteousness, meaning God's commandments, and he uses his tongue to speak truthfully. Verse 3, he who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. So he acts in the way of the royal law. He's loving his neighbor. Verse 4, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fears the Lord. Then David is going to give us another criteria for being in God's kingdom. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. Verse 4, he who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. So what does he mean, swearing to his own hurt and does not change? Well, simply put, he means he follows through on the verbal statements that he's made, even on vows, even if later it may become hard to do, even if keeping his word begins to hurt. Now, let's notice a few places in the scripture where people actually made vows. Remember, a vow is issued and involves God. Turn over to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28, and we'll start in verse 10. Now, the background to this story is here we have the patriarch Isaac, and he has sent his son Jacob away from home to find a wife. He didn't want Jacob to marry a woman from the foreign people that were living around him, like his brother Esau had already done. So he sends him away in verse 10. Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and he put it at his head and he lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed all families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So in this dream, God repeats to Jacob many of the specific promises that he had already given years before to Abraham, and then he passed on to Isaac. And here God is adding the same promises to Jacob. So as a result of this vivid dream, Jacob seems to have had somewhat of a life-changing experience. Verse 18, then Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put at his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. Verse 20, then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I'm going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So again, you kind of get the sense that Jacob was not perhaps fully committed to following his father's God until he had this experience. And you may recall that he had acted in some very less than honorable ways before he left. He had deceived his father. He had taken his brother's birthright and also his blessings. But now that he's here in the wilderness and he now makes a vow, a promise to God, that he will follow God. And he will also pay tithes of the blessing that God gives him. So did Jacob indeed follow God from that point on in his life? Well, yes, in much of the remainder of Genesis, we see the story of Jacob and his family seeking God and receiving help as well as blessings. So let's look at one other incident of a person making a vow to God. Now, this one is quite a distance in the future. It's during the time of the judges. So go to the book of Judges, and we'll start in chapter 11. And I'm going to read this one in the New Living Translation, Judges chapter 11. Now Jephthah of Gilead was a great warrior. He was the son of Gilead, but his mother was a prostitute. You recall that the book of Judges covers a time when the people of Israel had moved into the promised land after Moses passed away, but later they'd begun to stray from God's laws. So here in the time of Jephthah is another situation where we find the people of Israel are not very close to God. That happens throughout the book of Judges, as you know. Verse 2, Gilead's wife had also had several sons, and when these half-brothers grew up, they chased Jephthah off the land. "You will not get any of our father's inheritance," they said, "for you are the son of a prostitute." So Jephthah fled from his brothers, and he lived in the land of Tob, and soon he had a band of worthless rebels following him. Now, about this time, the Ammonites began their war against Israel. You remember throughout Judges, there are various enemies of Israel who begin to move into their land and oppress them. And this is one case where the Ammonites are doing that. When the Ammonites attacked, the elders of Gilead sent for Jephthah in the land of Tob. And the elders said, "Come and be our commander. Help us fight the Ammonites." Jephthah said to them, "Aren't you the ones who hated me and drove me from my father's house? Why do you come now when you're in trouble?" "Because we need you," the elders replied. "If you lead us in battle against the Ammonites, we'll make you ruler over all the people of Gilead." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him ruler and commander of the army. At Mizpah, in the presence of the Lord, Jephthah repeated what he had said to the elders. Verse 29, at that time the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he went throughout the land of Gilead and Manasseh, including Mizpah and Gilead, and from there he led an army against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. He said, "If you will give me victory over the Ammonites," so this man Jephthah, he needed help in battle, and he makes a vow to God asking for victory over the Ammonites. And what exactly does he say in this vow? Well, we're going to see that in verse 31. He says, "I will give to the Lord whatever comes out of my house to meet me when I return in triumph. I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." So Jephthah led his army against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave him victory. He crushed the Ammonites, devastated about 20 towns from Arior to an area near Minnith, and as far away as Abel Karamim. On the way, Israel defeated the Ammonites. Okay, so God has heard his prayer, and he's answered his vow by helping Israel defeat their enemies. So now it's time for Jephthah to keep his end of the bargain. Verse 34. When Jephthah returned to Mizpah, his daughter came out to meet him, playing on a tambourine and dancing for joy. She was his one and only child. He had no other sons and daughters. When he saw her, he tore his clothes in anguish. "Oh, my daughter," he cried out, "you have completely destroyed me. You've brought disaster on me, for I have made a vow to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." And she said, "Father, if you've made a vow to the Lord, you must do to me what you have vowed, for the Lord has given you a great victory over your enemies, the Ammonites." When she returned home, her father kept the vow he had made, and she died a virgin. So it has become a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite. So this story and this vow has become somewhat of a source of controversy. Remember what Jephthah had promised in his vow to God. He said, "I will give to the Lord whatever comes out of my house to meet me when I return in triumph. I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." So we read that he did keep his vow. So does that mean that he later fulfilled it by offering his daughter as a burnt offering? Well, many think that's exactly what happened. And some people today actually use this story as an example of the cruelty of God, the God of the Bible. But if we read it carefully, that's not exactly what took place here. First, it says in verse 29 that God had given Jephthah his spirit. So he would not have knowingly chosen to disobey God. And further, we know that human sacrifice is an abomination to God. There's no provision in God's law for the sacrifice of a person or anything that's unclean. So what did take place here? Well, the statement that Jephthah made can have various different translations. And without going to all the possible versions, the most likely meaning of this vow was that he meant this: the one who comes forth to meet me, I will consecrate to the Lord, or if no one comes out, I will offer him a burnt, a burnt offering. So he really meant that if the person came out of his house, he would consecrate that person to God. However, based on his reaction when his daughter came out, it's clear that Jephthah had not really thought very through carefully what he was what he should have considered when he made that vow. His daughter was then obligated from that point on to be a virgin and never marry. So Jephthah would never have grandchildren as a result of this vow that he made. So in this story, we see an example of what David said in Psalm 15, verse 4, about keeping a vow to your own hurt. Both Jephthah and his daughter were hurt in various ways by his vow. Now, let me state that there is a basic principle that applies with vows, and it's the same thing that applies to anything we might say. Neither a vow nor any other statement can obligate someone to break God's law or any of his other commandments. Now, the example we read about Jacob took place well before the law was given to Moses. But here in Judges, the time setting was many years after the law had been given at Mount Sinai. But God at Mount Sinai felt this subject was so important that he included several statements as regulations about how to handle and the impact of vows. So let's notice what God says about this subject. Turn back to the book of Numbers. Turn to Numbers, and we're going to read from chapter 30. Now, perhaps you've never really read these statements over very carefully. I know that I'd never had looked at them really carefully before I'd done this message. Numbers 30 and verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds from his mouth. Or if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth. So let's stop right there and look at a couple points. To begin with, the vow is made voluntarily, either by a man or by a woman. And as we read before, the vow is directed and includes God. They've made statements to God. And regarding verse 2, which is focused on a woman making a vow, she's spoken this while she's living under her father's roof. She's in her father's house, but she's not yet married. And so her father is responsible for her. And she somehow has made a vow to God. Now, up to now, we've limited our focus to vows that were made to God. But here in Numbers, God expands his discussion a little bit more. Besides a vow, he also added the statement, by some agreement. That was in verse 3. In the New Living Translations, it's translated as a pledge under oath. So what exactly is God referring to when he makes this statement? Well, the word for oath in Hebrew is esar, E-S-A-R. It means a bond, an obligation, some kind of a binding obligation. It doesn't include a reference or an obligation to God, but it's what we might say in our society, swearing an oath. Now, like a vow, it's not something that's to be made casually. In our society, people will say, I swear, and then they follow that by a statement of what they intend to do. So here we have a young woman who's old enough to make a binding oath and obligate herself to make some kind of an action. But she's still under her father's responsibility. So does that situation impact the vow or the oath that she's just taken? Let's go to verse 4. And her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she has bound herself. In other words, the oath that she's spoken. and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. So her father finds out that she's either vowed to God or she's sworn by some oath. But having heard what she said, he makes no comment about it. So by holding his tongue when he hears it, God considers that he's let her words stand. She has to follow through on the obligation that she's made. Verse 5, but if her father overrules her on that day that he hears her, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will release her, because her father overruled her. So when her father hears a description of how she's made an obligation for herself, he has the option at that moment to disallow it, and if he objects to it, he in effect cancels what she said. Now, in verse 6, we go on to a slightly different situation. If indeed she takes a husband, while bound by her vows or by her rash utterance from her lips by which she has bound herself, implying that maybe what she said was not so wise to begin with. Verse 7, and her husband hears it, and he makes no response to her on the day he hears, then her vows shall stand, and her agreements by which she bound herself shall stand. Now we're talking about a woman who's now gotten married, and the vows or the oaths that she'd made before she got married comes to the attention of her new husband. He apparently was unaware of them before they got married. But now that he's heard about her vow or her oath, he has the same option as her father did when she was in his house. He can say nothing, and her statements or obligations will stand. She will still have the obligation to keep whatever she said. Verse 8, but if her husband overrules her on the day when he hears it, he shall make void her vow which she took and what she uttered with her lips by which she bound herself, and the Lord will release her. So just like her father, her husband has a one-time opportunity to overrule her vows or her oaths when they first come to his attention. He can't wait days or weeks and then decide much later that he now has misgivings and he speaks up about it. His opportunity to intervene is when he first finds what her obligations are that she's previously made. Now in verse 9, we go to another situation. Also, the vow of any widow or a divorced woman by which she has bound herself shall stand against her if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an agreement with an oath. And her husband heard it and made no response to her and did not overrule her, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But again, repeating in verse 12, that her husband heard, if she made a vow and her husband heard it on the day that he heard it, he makes void what she has said, it does not stand. So let's go down to verse 14. Now, if her husband makes no response whatever to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows or all the agreements that bind her. He confirms them because he has made no response to her on the day that he heard them. So again, we find that God holds very serious the words that we speak, and especially as it concerns a vow or an oath. Now let's notice a couple additional statements that God makes on this subject. Deuteronomy 23, you don't need to turn there. Deuteronomy 23, verse 21. Moses writes, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. For the Lord your God would surely require it of you, and it would be a sin to you. So we talked at the beginning of this message about what we say in a vow can be a sin if we don't follow up on it. And Solomon adds some other words of wisdom and warning on this subject. In Proverbs 13, verse 3, he says, he who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction. Now, Solomon apparently gave some very serious thought to making vows to God, and he also tells us that it's a serious matter. Turn over to Ecclesiastes 5. We'll see some more words of Solomon. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 4, he says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Verse 6, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? So clearly here God shows us that making a vow to God and failing to pay it is considered by God to be a sin. And the bottom line is that we should think very carefully before we make promises to God. One reason could be that we simply don't know if the circumstances tomorrow may be what they are today. Will we be able to fulfill the vows that we make? Now, this warning from Solomon also brings to mind a statement that Christ made in Luke 14:28. You probably remember that. I won't turn there. It's talking about counting the cost. So we spent a considerable time looking at vows, and we've seen that they're voluntary promises that a person makes to God. Generally, they involve asking God to fulfill some desire or need or making a personal commitment to take some action as a result. But let's move on to a different situation. The Bible also talks about oaths. Now, there's a difference between an oath and a vow, whereas a vow is directed to God and it requests God's involvement. An oath may mention God, but it's not necessarily directed to him. Let's look at the first occasion that an oath is recorded in the Bible. If you would turn to Genesis 21 and verse 22. Genesis 21, verse 22. And as a background, here we have Abraham, and he's conversing with Abimelech. Abimelech was the king of the land in which Abraham was temporarily living. Verse 22, Genesis 21, 22. And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. So he recognized that God was blessing Abraham. He says, now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you've dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. So the word spoken as swear comes from the Hebrew word saba, or it's pronounced shaba, and it means to swear or to take an oath. But like an oath, it carries a serious responsibility. So when a person swears or takes an oath, in both cases, they're bound to fulfill what they've said. Now, in our day and age, we use the word swear to mean two basic things. One is a kind of a curse, meaning they use filthy language or crude language. And this type of swearing can be heard almost daily in our society, even on TV and movies. But God says in Ephesians 5 verse 4 that we should never, ever use that type of language. The second meaning of swearing is similar to the biblical usage that we've just read, but very few people in this society recognize the serious responsibility that it has before God. Most people in our society fail to make any commitment when they swear. The closest situation that we have is when swearing involves an oath taken primarily in a legal setting. When a person's statements are made before a judge or even made to a policeman who's recognized as an officer of the court, American law requires the swearing of an oath. Somehow an oath in this case supposedly carries a higher degree of truthfulness. But again, in God's word, an oath has serious expectation regardless of the legal setting. If a person swears or makes an oath before God, it's expected to be carried out. Now let's notice one more example of an oath in God's word. Go forward, we're still in Genesis. Go forward in Genesis chapter 50. And we'll look at 50, verse 24. And this is now come to the end of Joseph's life. He's still in Egypt, but he's close to dying. Genesis 50, verse 24, and Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So who was it that agreed to this oath with the dying Joseph? Well, it may have been some of the children of Jacob, his brothers. We don't know how many of those were alive at the time. And perhaps it was some of their sons. So what happened after he died? Well, the Israelites lived in Egypt for hundreds of years into the future. And surely that oath was eventually forgotten as those centuries passed. So go forward to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus 13, God is now delivering the children of Israel out of Egypt. And we'll read verse 19. Exodus 13, 19, and Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, the verse that we read a few minutes ago, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. So clearly the oath that was made to those present at Joseph's deathbed had been passed on to the children of each subsequent generation. So when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt years later, they still held that oath as being an absolute requirement. So we see an excellent example of what it meant to swear and to make an oath. Now, in the interest of time, we won't go there, but you can also make a note, another example of holding true to an oath, and that's in Joshua chapter 9. Joshua 9, he gives an example of Joshua holding an oath as well. So we've seen that vows to God, as well as oaths, all carry a great responsibility. But what about us in our time? When Christ came, did he change anything? Are we now permitted to make vows or oaths to God? Well, let's go forward to the New Testament and see what, if anything, God has changed. Do Christians have a different responsibility regarding vows and oaths? Well, there's only two references in the New Testament using the word vow. And both of these are speaking of a specific type of vow called a Nazirite vow. Now, we didn't cover that in the Old Testament, but if you want to go back and read the requirements of a Nazirite vow, it's in Numbers 6. In agreement with all the other descriptions of vows that we saw, a Nazirite vow is a formal set of requirements between a man, or it could be a woman, and God. And it was for a set period of time, as determined by the person who made the vow, and required that they not shave their head, not consume or touch any product derived from a grape, and not go near a dead body. And both references to vows in the New Testament, we find the Apostle Paul has bound himself under the provision of a Nazirite vow. It's also thought that John the Baptist may have had a Nazirite vow for his entire life, but there's not enough facts in the New Testament to say that for sure. So a vow since the time of Christ appears to be still acceptable. So what about taking of an oath? Well, there's several examples of oaths in the New Testament. But those that are made are not shown in a positive light. In Matthew 26:72, we won't turn there, but Peter swore an oath, you'll remember, when he was accused by a servant girl as being a follower of Jesus. And the word here and throughout the New Testament for oath is orkos, O-R-K-O-S, meaning that which has been pledged or promised with an oath. Peter swore an oath, but in that case, he had lied doing so. And another example of swearing an oath is in the case of Herod. You remember at his birthday party, he made an oath to his stepdaughter, who was Herodias. After she danced, he swore by an oath that he would give her whatever she wanted. And unfortunately, she and her mother asked for the head of the death of John the Baptist. Now, one other case we're going to turn to, Acts 23 and verse 11. Acts 23, verse 11. And this is when Paul has returned to Jerusalem from one of his journeys. And a few Jews were not happy at all that he had come back. We'll start in verse 12. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. But God, as we know, was protecting Paul. So we know that this group was never able to fulfill their oath. So we might wonder, did they all die from starvation? Well, we simply don't know. Nevertheless, we can see that it was a foolish oath and was also one against God's law because it involved murder. Now, we've seen several examples of oaths in the New Testament, and these and others often did not have positive outcomes. So does Christ have anything to tell us about making oaths? Well, he did, and he gave his disciples some very simple requirements about making oaths. Matthew 5, verse 33. You'll be familiar with this section. Matthew 5, verse 33, Christ says, "Again you have heard that it was said of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform your oath to the Lord,'" which we read. What was he referring to when he says those of old? Well, we read the scripture he was speaking about in Numbers 30, verse 2. He was quoting from Numbers 30, verse 2. But verse 34 here, "But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black." So why does he make this statement about our head? How does our hair impact his warning about not to swear? Well, he's simply pointing out that we don't have control over certain things. And in fact, in this life, we have very little control over many things. So instead of swearing, what should we do? Verse 37, Christ says, "Let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." So Christ simply tells us as Christians that our words should always be truthful. No other emphasis is needed to emphasize what we say. It's not necessary to add any statements like, "I swear," or even worse, which we hear quite often, to invoke the name of Christ or God. We hear that quite often. Certainly doing so would be breaking the third commandment. God says just giving our word as a Christian is expected to be enough. Now notice also what James, in James 4, says about this. In book of James, chapter 4, Christ's half-brother says this in verses 13. "Come now, you who say, 'Today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit.'" So here's a person who's making plans. He's going to do some business in another city, and as a result, he expects to make a profit, perhaps maybe bring home a lot of money. But like many examples in the Bible, he's leaving God out of the equation. So what advice does James have? Verse 14, "Therefore you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that.'" So just as Christ said in Matthew, we do need to acknowledge that there are things that are simply beyond our control. So we need to be careful about what statements we make about things that we might be tempted to state as a promise or as an oath. Now, unfortunately, there are many circumstances in this world where you might be asked to swear an oath. In a court of law, before giving testimony is one. On many legal forms will be written a place for you to sign that you swear to the legal terms of the document. However, most legal forms can simply be handled by scratching out with your pen the word "swear" and writing in "affirm." Our word as a Christian is an affirmation. If you're in a courtroom, you may need to explain to the judge or the court representative that you cannot swear, but you're willing to affirm. And almost all courts have made a provision for people for religious reasons that cannot swear. Are there valid times in which we may make an oath? Well, when we're baptized, we state that we've repented of our sins and accepted the sacrifice of Christ, intending from that time forward to obey and to yield to God's will. We're held to that oath as a vow to God. And when two people are married, their statement before the pastors are an affirmation, an oath, and a vow since it's before God. But beyond baptism and marriage, should we as Christians avoid making a vow? Well, the answer is not necessarily no. Just as in the Old Testament, a vow is initiated by an individual and involves what we tell God we will do. You can vow to God that you're going to fast, perhaps the length of time and when you'll start. You could vow to God something like Jacob did. If you bless me in this endeavor, whatever it is, I'll give you 20% as an offering. That would be a vow because you've made it to God. But as we've seen, when you vow, you've made a commitment. Don't fail to meet your commitments to God. So today, as we've looked at the subject of vows and oaths and swearing, vows are initiated by an individual but directed to God. It involves a person asking God to help in some way and making a commitment to act in a certain way in return. Vows are not required, but if they're made, we have to fulfill them. Oaths are also a commitment. We've seen that both oaths and vows are serious situations that require that we fulfill what we've spoken. So again, I'm going to finish with the words of Solomon. Solomon's words in Ecclesiastes, I'll read verse 2 and 4 through 6. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 2, "Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few." Verse 4, "When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. For he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands?"